the UCR Podcast.
Dave Mustaine of Megadeth is on the podcast today, my friends, and it's an important week in the world of Megadeth. The final album from the thrash metal legends hit the shelves today, and maybe you were there last night on the eve of the release. Fans gathered at local theaters nationally to hear the record for the first time together as part of a new documentary called Megadeth Behind the Mask. Let's start with some good news. If you missed seeing the documentary last night, you've got one more shot tomorrow, Saturday, January 24th. Showtimes and tickets are available at megadethfilm.com. I know that there are some gnarly winter storms on tap for some of you hearing this right now, but if you can get safely out there to see it, it doesn't seem like a bad way to spend a Saturday from where I'm sitting. Dave and I get into a lot of today's interview, including the new film, the reason this is the final Megadeth album, some war stories from the past, and also some thoughts from Dave regarding what's next for him once he's done with Megadeth. But as you might know, it's going to be a while before that happens because they have quite a lot of touring to do, including the initial dates that are on tap that will also feature Anthrax and Exodus on the bill. Megadeth.com is where you can find information on all things Megadeth. And you know what? We've talked about this, but putting that to the side, let's just suppose that you are hearing this podcast for the first time. If you're new here, welcome in, grab a seat, and hit the follow button so that you will get future episodes of the pod as they're released. And if you find yourself enjoying what you're hearing, you know how this kind of thing works. Please rate and review wherever you might be listening. Now, here is our conversation with Dave Mustaine. Enjoy. It seems like it's probably been fun for you to kind of take stock of your career in this way.
Well, you know what? It's been even funner is to have other people take stock in my career because I'm able to hear a lot of things that are important to them. And in some instances, stuff I've had forgotten about, you know, I forgot about the Genesis Award from Doris Day for Countdown to Extinction. I forgot about the Clio Award for us having virtual reality performances on Dystopia a couple records back. And so the fans could do the whole Oculus Rift experience.
When you consider 40 years of Megadeth history in that way, like you've certainly have done that before in a certain sense, as you say, like you've done interviews, you've written books. So you had that opportunity, as you just kind of laid out, to kind of come across things that you had forgotten about in the band's history, which I think is pretty common because you're just out there doing the work and there's all sorts of things that go by as you're doing that you don't really have a chance to take stock of or perhaps appreciate until later. What was kind of personally interesting to you overall as you sat there kind of considering the history and the scope of what you've done?
Oh, God, that's a big question. There was a lot that was interesting about it. You know, if you put the first record and you compare it to the last record, there's so much similarity to it. I think that's because of the rawness and the I don't give a shit attitude that we went into making this record. I told Timo, I said, man, we got to make sure that we solo our asses off on this record because that's what people are going to expect from this. And we did. And he was really helpful for me because, you know, man, as I've said, I've been having issues with my hands. And there was one part I was having a little bit of some noise with, and I was playing it and I couldn't get it to stop making noise. And then all of a sudden I felt this thing on the headstock and I looked over and Timu had reached over and he was helping me by holding my guitar. And I went, you know how long it's been since I've had a guitar partner like that? It has been a long time. Now, I've had a lot of guitar partners that are great players and they're great people. And we had a really great time together, but I can't remember any person that ever did anything like that with me.
And in the trailer for the film, you said that you think when this record comes out, a lot of people are going to be really happy just to see how we close this circle. And knowing those expectations can sometimes make achieving what you're out to do a difficult thing. But Dave, it seems like in this case, it's a narrative which helped to kind of guide you in a certain sense.
Yeah. You know, when you say that, I think of that silly Garmin digital map thing and Ozzy's voice on it. You're going the wrong way. It was definitely a motivator because, looking at the roadmap we had left coming up to this, there was quite a lot of definitive moments in guitar playing and in Megadeth music and for frontmen that sing and play guitar. There's a lot of challenging parts that have really helped to give birth to great frontmen that play guitar and sing. And I love that. You know, when I first was asked by the band to sing, it was a New Year's Eve many, many, many years ago. And we were trying to audition singers and we just couldn't do it. And then one night, the band guy said, why don't you try singing? And I said, why don't you? And we kind of dicked around that like that. And then the next thing you know, I'm singing. And the next thing you know, after that, I'm the singer, which was a huge paradigm shift for me because, you know, I'd always thought that front men were a different breed. And once I became one, I thought, now I've got to make this look cool.
How did you find your way? Because certainly there are all sorts of people who are interesting singers like an Alice Cooper or whoever you would want to name off that could show you in your shoes there's a path that, you know, having a unique voice is actually good. But how did you find your way in a way that felt sense to you where you're like, okay, this works for me being the front man?
Funny you mention Alice because he's my godfather and he did have that talk with me. But you know, there's not a lot of people in music that I don't know if it's they don't have the heart or if they don't have the balls, but a lot of times people don't give advice. And I think for me and my circumstances, I don't like to give advice unless people have asked me for it because, you know, honestly, giving advice when it's not asked for is plain God. You know, I would rather.
Yeah.
I'd rather someone say, hey, you know, I noticed that you do something like this. Can you show me what you do? And I'd say, sure. I'm not going to tell you how to do it, but I'll show you how I did it. And if you want to try it and you need some help, certainly I can help you, but I'm not going to tell you what to do. That's not cool.
Is there kind of a moment that you remember, though, where it's like you've kind of felt like I'm in the right zone?
When we were up in Indigo Ranch God, where was that place at? It was up in Malibu. It was the old Moody Blues studio, and we'd gone up there, and we had some personnel problems where the guy we started with as a manager ended up pulling a knife on the band while we were out in New York, and he was also working in a capacity as a producer, blah, 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 whatever he could say, whatever us young kids would buy because we had no idea what a producer did anyway. So we'd gotten out there and it was just one night and it was really creepy out there because, you know, Indigo Ranch is up this dirt road a couple miles into the hills. Have you ever been there, Matt?
I haven't been there, but it's the kind of place that you would expect the Moody Blues to have, right?
It was sketchy. And they had, rumor had it that they had gotten a bunch of foot lockers and filled it full of drugs and shit and buried it out in the yard out there. So guess who was out? Guess whose band, I should say, had guys out there trying to get metal detectors. We had a couple guys that were working for us that they'd gone to, what's that place called? Hobby Lobby. And they got some metal detectors because they wanted to go out there and see if there was any foot lockers they could find. Anyway, so I was there and I was singing. And I remember when I came up with an idea and when the idea worked, I felt like I could do this. It was me singing the verses on Killing Is My Business because I have a low voice. I am a sniper. And then I can't even do that high one without warming my voice up right now. But then I do a really high one on top of it. And I noticed that when that record came out and I listened to that, I realized very few people did that where they had they sang unison with themselves, but one was an octave lower than the other one. It's a very different approach, and that's when I realized that, you know, I had fun doing that too.
You know, watching the trailer again for this upcoming film, it was interesting because you say that this album, this new album, is one that continually reveals itself. And having heard this record, I think that makes sense when you hear these songs. Like, I enjoyed listening to the album because it feels like lyrically and also occasionally perhaps sonically, there are perhaps career reference type of Easter eggs that are tucked into various spots. Did you have that kind of thing in mind as you're writing lyrics and stuff like that for this record? Was there a conceptual element to it?
Zero.
Okay.
Zero, because I didn't have this conversation with management until we were halfway through with the record. And once we were at that point, that's when I thought I would say something, because I had really painful stretch of tracking. My hands were hurting really bad, and I just said something matter of fact. You know, I don't know how much longer I can do this, and that's all I said. The conversation turned into a band conversation, and then we made the announcement. And you know, I mean, honestly, when it's all said and done, that's when I would worry about what's going to happen. Just keep the faith until then.
How much did having that realization kind of turn the tide of the overall record as far as where it was headed?
I've been thinking about this for a while because I had said, this was a thing that David Ellison and I used to say, that we were going to go out when it was time, and we weren't going to keep going after it was time. I don't know how he feels about where he's at in his journey, but I can tell you, if a lot of people out there knew how difficult the decision was, they would appreciate, you know, coming to that conclusion and how hard we worked on making this record the best record we possibly could make.
It's really interesting, Dave, because I think I can feel, just as an observer, what that decision would have felt like, just because you have a certain amount of peace when you arrive at the decision that maybe it's time to turn it in, but also that's very, very difficult. So even if you know that it's time, that still doesn't make it any easier, right?
No.
Yeah.
It's very painful, you know, especially when you hear from people that say that they, it breaks their heart, or that the thought of there not being any Megadeth anymore. And I have to reassure them, the music will live on forever. It'll live on forever. And right now we've got a great opportunity to be together and to sing songs together one last time. And, you know, I would love to do some live recordings. I think it'd be great for us to expand the playlist of the songs in our catalog for our fans. And you know, that only happens when the ticket draws are strong, and when we play places that we have two nights in a row or three nights in a row, that's when we have the luxury of mixing the set list up really strong. You know, we can change it from night to night, but you know, if the fans were going to go see two shows in their city, I think it's a really professional approach to change your set list up every night, you know, because you don't know how many people are going to be out there that are seeing you both nights.
It also feels very appropriate, Dave, that you've got Anthrax and Exodus on the bill for this tour. That's pretty cool. These three bands are going out.
Yeah, it is pretty cool, I think. There was a few times where we would see each other in passing out on the road, and that was always fun, as we'd come and we'd hang out and show support, because you know, that was what our scene was about. You know, we would always support one another. I don't know how strong that is with the new generation of bands, if they do that now, but I know back in the day that's what we did. We would, like, if we ever rolled from Los Angeles up to San Francisco. We would get there a day ahead of time. We'd spend the night at somebody's house and crash on their floor. And we would go out to the Stone or to the Old Mabuhay or something like that. And then we would play the next night. And we would spend the night again on sleep on the floor because we'd been drinking and we didn't want to ever drink and drive going home. So
sure.
Plus, there was so much fun to be had in the early days up in SF.
Another thing that I loved about this new record is that there's the bonus track of Bloodlust, which is a nice unexpected surprise. I wondered, like, how indicative, Dave, is that of the album sessions overall? Did you end up with other songs that are presently unreleased but similarly finished?
Have you heard Bloodlust?
I have not heard it yet, no.
Yeah. Okay, so that song is finished. And it was really hard because Robots Rule, Bloodlust, those songs both were songs that I really, really liked. And it was just the popular vote. Both those songs lost out. Now they're there. They're going to be on some different releases, but they just didn't end up on the main release.
I like the way this record wraps up with the last note, and the last thing that we hear in that song is at the end of it, you say, "Now I disappear." It's probably a nice feeling, Dave, the idea that you could just put it all down and do anything else if you want to do that. But how much, Dave, are there non-Megadeth type of musical creative challenges that you've got in your sights? Like, what's kind of still on your bucket list?
Gosh, I'm not sure how to answer that, Matt. You know, my personal stuff that I want to do. I'd like to do some sightseeing with my wife and my kids and my granddaughter, spend some time with the family.
I think
that would be great. I'd love to find a band and just take them from beginning to end, from, you know, whatever it takes to get a record out and to see if we can make them. Because, you know, it really is a formula. And if you know what you're doing, you can do it.
Well, last couple of things here. One, we've talked about the film. How did the idea to do that film kind of come about? And what's that involved for you as far as, like, are you pulling out, like, archival stuff? Is there footage you're digging up? Like, what did that piece of things look like?
Doing the movie, I think, was really great because it got everybody caught up to where we're at right now. And that gave everybody a look at our history one more time. And it was a playthrough of the album also. I described the songs and talk a lot about how we walked through the history of the band and the different players and stuff. And I think that Casey had done a really great job with footage that he got, because there's a lot of B-side footage that's really cool stuff that, you know, I knew where it was that he had filmed it, but I had no idea that he had it. I mean, he didn't film it, but he acquired it somewhere. Some of the stuff I knew was floating around, but it was also great to see it laid out the way that it was, because, you know, I miss those times. Those times were so innocent and raw and just so powerful.
What was some of the footage you really enjoyed seeing? Like, just that stuck out there? You're like, oh man.
Some of the old band guys, you know, stuff like that. You know, that's the stuff that I thought was really neat. Seeing Gar, you know, there's different stuff that was personal to me. I watched it over at the front of our house with the gigantic stereo system. And that was really a neat experience, too, because it reminded me when I was little, seeing movies at motion picture palaces, like the one in Stanton, California, where you could go in there and watch Fritz the Cat and shit like that.
Yeah. You said something early on just about the consistency of the records, and that was something that was really interesting to me, Dave, because I had a conversation with a friend last week that was just talking about how, you know, he went away to college and all that kind of stuff. So he got off the Megadeth path a little bit, even though he remained a fan. So we were talking about some of the albums that came after Cryptic Writings and so on. And as I was kind of telling him about the specific records leading up to now, Dave, I think outside of maybe Risk, which people debate that record, and you've made all these records that are really consistently Megadeth, they've got a very consistent thread, even as at the same time you're pushing forward creatively. So it's not like you were in a box just making the same record over and over. That's a really hard balance to strike, to maintain that consistency while still pushing forward and kind of following whatever your muse is at the time. How do you think you pulled that off just overall?
I don't know. I guess I've always been a good listener.
Yeah.
You know, there's a difference between hearing something and listening to it. And I've always listened to songs and tried to see where's the bone in the fish, you know, where is the melody, you know, what is the hook to the whole thing? And you know, it's real easy for me right now. I guess at my point in my career to listen to songs and kind of see why people wrote the way that they did. You know, I can hear a song pretty much by any band and know where they're going to go next, you know, especially with country bands, and pop bands, metal bands. It's not always as easy as I would think, but I love listening to song theory. That's a really neat stage in my life where I'm at, where I can listen to the theory behind the songs.
Well, here's where I'm going to leave it, man. And that just is, for us as fans, it is poignant to know that we are getting a full circle moment of your version of Ride the Lightning. There are important threads there. What does the song itself mean to you personally? What did it mean to you to do that?
Well, there's two parts in the song that were key character guitar parts that I do. The spider chord is one that I invented. Spider chord is, if you had you were doing a bar chord, you'd have your bar chord like this, right? So I thought, wouldn't it be cool if I held a bar chord right here and I slammed these two down over here? So it goes, right? And then the other one is grunting, where I used to, if a riff would go bum 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 bum, I would go down a half a fret. I'd go bum 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 bum, and that's called grunting. And I know nobody really knows the theory behind that, but those are two things that when James and I first started playing, it was really dominant in our playing. And I wanted to do Ride the Lightning because those were two parts that I wanted to be, I wanted to show them how I played those parts. They're key signature parts.
What did that bring out for you going in and doing that though? There's having the idea, but then there's doing it.
Yeah, well, you know, as I was alluding to earlier about, you know, doing covers on albums versus doing my version of this, the only thing I really wanted to do was do it as good as they did it. And if I did it as good as they did it or better, then, you know, hey, amen. And I wanted to show respect to Lars and James, because James is a great guitar player. You know, I one night I'm playing on the stage at a place called The Whiskey, and there's a guy on my right playing guitar, and James is in the middle, and I'm on the left. And then the next time I'm at rehearsal, guy on the right ain't nowhere to be found, and guy in the middle has a guitar while he's singing. And I thought, wow. James got really fucking good fast. Hooray for me and hooray for the band. You know, I wanted to just show respect to James and to Lars. You know, Lars is a great songwriter, and I did have a lot of fun with those guys. You know, I'm not living in the past. It's good to do that to close the circle, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's what we did. So it's kind of my way of saying thanks to everybody from beginning to right this very second.
Well, man, I enjoyed this record a lot, and I'm looking forward to hearing it in the cinema setting. And, of course, we'll look forward to getting a chance to see the tour as well, man. This is going to be fun to see how this all unfolds. And, you know, congrats as you enter this next chapter here.
Ah, thanks, Mindy. Hey, when I get to, you said you're in Cleveland, yeah?
Yeah.
And I get out there next time we're playing. Please come find me and we'll have a cup of coffee or a beer or something and we'll pick up where we left off on this conversation. Does that sound good?
That sounds good, man. We'll do it. So all right, thank pal. You, man.
Hey, have a great New Year's. One. Happy New Year's to
Likewise.
You.
Likewise. All right, man. All right. Take care.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.